It's an update on some of the biggest transportation projects on the First Coast. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes or live on our Facebook page. Just ahead, whether it's the Outer Beltway, the Overland Bridge, or something else, you can get on the line now with FDOT and get your questions answered about all the biggest transportation projects all across the region. The number to join us, 549-2937. Then later, it's the second annual Swim Shorts Film Festival, your chance to celebrate the St. John's River with film. Plus, Culpepper on the Sharks' hopes for a championship. That's tonight. All of that ahead. But first this hour, a massive multi-million dollar project that's been under construction on Jacksonville's south side for years now is finally nearing completion. And you can weigh in on how this finished product will look. The Florida Department of Transportation is hosting an open house this Thursday to get feedback on how to landscape the $227 million Overland Bridge project. Now, construction of the Overland Bridge, as it's called, began in 2013. And the idea is to replace the overpasses that carry traffic over Hendricks, Kings, and Montana Avenues along a two-mile stretch of I-95 right near downtown Jacksonville. The project is widening I-95 with one additional lane for southbound traffic, and it's scheduled to be all wrapped up this fall. That is a project a lot of downtown commuters want to hear about, but there are some other ones around the region we've got updates on as well. FDOT's Ron Tittle, Odette Stroys, and Mary Justino join us all now in studio to answer all of your transportation questions. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hey,
thanks
Melissa.
For having us.
Good morning.
And you guys got stuck in your own traffic on the way over here, didn't you? You made it on time, but you face the same traffic as everybody.
We drive the same roads everyone drives, and that's the whole thing. You know, we do understand. So it's important for us to make sure we get that information out in a timely manner, and that's what we hope we do.
All right, and the number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on Facebook. Ron Tittle, let's begin with you. As I mentioned, a big open house this Thursday on the Overland Bridge project. And can you bring us up to date on this project? What a massive thing it is. And it's been going on for, what, 4 years now?
Well, it has. And those of us who have driven through that area for a number of years, there's been ongoing construction, you know, because let's face it, back in the 50s and 60s, when some of these structures were built, we didn't have as much traffic. The vehicles weren't as large, you know, we don't have as many big trucks. So, and some of the structures themselves, you know, were built with that technology. So we've got to make adjustments. We've got to build new structures, you know, to accommodate even the size of vehicles and the speeds and the amount of traffic. If we don't do something through the area, particularly through Jacksonville, when we're looking at traffic conceivably doubling in the next, say, 20-something years. Yeah. So we've got to do something. And this is one of the major projects that we wanted to replace those structures and to make it a little bit more efficient in there.
This will really ease the commute through the whole downtown area on the south bank and then across the river onto the north bank of the river, correct? That's the idea?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're scheduled, say, fall of this year to get that project completed, you know, weather permitting and all that goes well. And actually, within about a month, say maybe the first part of August, we're anticipating a traffic shift for the drivers going northbound on 95, as you approach downtown. You will have to make a decision near the San Diego overpass, where Douglas Anderson School is, for instance. Then you've got to decide whether you're going to go downtown, whether you get in those lanes and be clearly marked by signage, or whether you go strictly on 95 north to go over the Fullerton Bridge. So those adjustments are coming, and we'll be on the new structure within about a month or so going northbound 95. So that's a good change.
Meanwhile, this Thursday, Odette Stroys, people can come to an open house at the FDOT building and give their opinions about some things related to this project.
Yes, we'll be inviting everyone to come between 4:30 and 6:30 on Thursday afternoon. We do hope you come if you have interest in the Overland landscaping, which is not scheduled to start till summer of 2019. But there is a discussion, and we'll have maps, and all our FDOT project team members, including our designers, will be there. We'll be discussing, you know, the variety of canopy and understory trees proposed to provide visual buffer, shade, and color within that corridor. Palms are even proposed to provide character and interest in the prominent locations. We're dealing with really tight spaces, so that's going to be a challenge, but certainly we're up for it.
And the number to join us, 549-2937. Mary Justino, this project downtown is getting a lot of attention, but FDOT is working on a lot of projects. And you have an update for all of our Clay County listeners, too.
For sure. And it's about the First Coast Expressway. That's the toll system that's State Road 23 that connects Clay County to the west side of Jacksonville. One interesting thing I found out recently in my meetings with the Chamber of Commerce and the economic development folks in Clay is about 60% of those of us who live in Clay County who work commute into Jacksonville every day. Mm-hmm. And so while Overland and other large projects here in downtown, folks who live in Duval County, of course it impacts them, but really it affects everyone who commutes into Jacksonville. And the important thing is you can't benefit from those amazing projects if you can't get here from the county you live in. So it's amazing to me to find out that even without the First Coast Expressway project, tens of millions of dollars are being spent by DOT in counties like Clay on making sure that those connecting roadways are what they're supposed to be. We're six-laning Blanding Boulevard, for example, in addition to the work on the expressway.
Right. And anyone who's driven down Blanding Boulevard knows that probably can't come soon enough.
That's right. So I think what you'll find is by about 3 years from now, Blanding Boulevard will be six lanes all the way south of Middleburg, which is pretty amazing if you grew up in that area.
Wow. And we'll go to your calls as we have all the FDOT spokes, almost all of them, spokespeople here in studio at 549-2937. But first, when we talk about Overland Bridge, there's a lot of excitement about the completion of that project and what it's going to mean for development in San Marco and neighboring St. Nicholas. Our news director, Jessica Palumbo, spoke recently with Ennis Davis of Modern Cities about that. We're going to listen to a portion of that right now.
Ennis, we're just talking about one exit here.
Yes, one exit. So this exit, which is where Atlantic Boulevard, Phillips Highway, and Kings Avenue converge, it'll be the first time that you'll have a gateway to San Marco and St. Nicholas from I-95 in 60 years.
When I'm thinking about where I want to put my business, I want easy highway access. I want people to be able to see it from 95.
Correct. You want to have as much visibility as possible, whether it's vehicular traffic or pedestrian traffic, a mix of both, and having this new interchange come in where you have increased visibility along all three of these corridors, which have been somewhat desolate now they're having a rebirth.
Have we seen the effect of this coming already?
In early 2016, Daly's, for example, opened up a new 5,000-square-foot gas station a block east of this interchange. And currently, a local developer, Mark Rubin, has started work on the reconstruction of an existing 7,500-square-foot building that'll be mixed use, featuring a restaurant at street level, as well as office space on the second floor. That project is just east of the FEC railroad crossing on Atlantic Boulevard in San Marco.
Things are already starting to be developed here, but there's a lot more to come after the new exit is open at Atlantic Boulevard. What can we expect?
There are a couple major projects that really complement each other. One is being proposed by Jacksonville-based Chance Partners. This is a multifamily developer that is looking into taking a former 17-acre car dealership and putting the mixed-use project that could have as many as 640 apartment units. That's going to be on Phillips Highway right at the new interchange. The impact of significant new residential growth and development has led to a boom in a complement industry, which is the self-storage industry. Nationwide, there's about $1 billion worth of construction projects in this industry taking place around the country. Jacksonville is a new growth area. And so just north of Phillips Highway on Kings Avenue, there are two projects proposed that will begin construction this fall. Combined, you're looking at about 1,400 climate-controlled self-storage units, as well as about 220,000 square feet of space in four-story buildings.
Okay, Ron Tittle, lots of excitement about the completion of this project in terms of what we could see in that area once that interchange is complete. And for people that are trying to get a visual on this, if they're coming north on I-95, is this right? You'll be able to exit off I-95 right onto Atlantic Boulevard in a much easier way than you can now.
Absolutely, and we don't have that ramp open currently, and it will. All of that should be completed by fall. And like you're going northbound, you want to get off on Atlantic. You can go up under 95 and you go on over toward Kings Road, and then on. King Street there, but anyway, also toward Phillips as well. And also part of that particular area, we're adding bike lanes in there too. Some of it will be shared road structure, but some of it was separated bike lanes. So we're looking at complete streets all along too, to be able to accommodate cycling, biking, and driving as well. So it's going to be good for economic development.
Odette.
Yeah, Jessica had mentioned there's a lot more to come, and projects really complement each other. And along those lines, in tandem with everything that we're talking about, once the Overland Bridge is completed, you'll see construction on I-95's Fuller Warren Bridge. Now, the Fuller Warren Bridge itself hasn't had construction other than maintenance since 2002. And she'd mentioned new growth daily, and you're right. We have about 250,000 people that use, or cars rather, that use the interchange I-95, I-10 every single day. And by 2040, that's going to be a significant increase to about 290,000 vehicles. To make that change now and accommodate that, we have to make the expansion now. What's going to be interesting and exciting about the expansion, other than adding extra lanes to Fuller Warren Bridge itself, we're also going to be including a shared use path to connect San Marco and Riverside neighborhoods. And this will be for bicyclists and pedestrians. And yes, you will be able to walk or ride your bike across the Fuller Warren Bridge in 3 years, depending on rain and unforeseen delays. We expect it to be completed summer of 2020.
All right. Lots of interest in all of these projects. What are your questions for FDOT? 549-2937. Alex is in Clay County. Hey, Alex, good morning.
Hey, good morning. So I live over there in Clay County, and I go over the Shands Bridge a lot, and I'm just curious, from what I hear, it's going to be destroyed whenever they put in the new toll, and going to destroy a lot of Bayard as well. A lot of people use that area. So kind of what's going on with that? Are you all actually destroying Shands Bridge, or how's that going down?
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Alex. Justina.
That is a great question. And that is more than 5 years out, but I do have some up-to-date information about the Shands Bridge. The new bridge will be built right next to the existing bridge on the south side. So you're right. It'll be on that Bayard side of State Road 16 where it crosses the existing Shands. The footprint, again, will be right next to it. There will be a stretch of the expressway that will come behind Bayard and up through that area. And certainly we are working with the Army Corps of Engineers and St. John's River Water Management to handle those permits and all of those arrangements. However, I do want to make sure that folks know that what will happen is when the new bridge is built, which will be a minimum of four lanes and two in each direction, and then room for growth, the old bridge will be taken down in the center, and existing ends will remain for pedestrians and for fishing, which is very popular in that area. So there will mm-hmm. be piers that will remain on either side. And also folks ask a lot about local access, because of course the expressway is a toll road. There will be a way for local travelers to access the bridge to cross the river toll-free. There will be dedicated lanes for that.
And when you talk about tolls, by the way, your team has really tried very hard to get the word out with all kinds of public hearings yeah. and meetings about the return of tolled lanes to the First Coast.
Right.
That's an ongoing effort by all of you.
That's right. Because we have two main projects, not just the expressway that I'm working on, but then the express lanes, which are the managed lanes on 295 and 95. And this is very much like what folks are experiencing in Tampa, Orlando, Miami, through the SunPass tolling program. It will be identical to that. And the SunPass transponder that you get to use our local systems will work all over the state of Florida.
It's Mary Justino, Ron Tittle, and Odette Stroys all speaking on behalf of FDOT this morning. Lots of questions for them about all of these projects. 549-2937. Virginia on the south side. Hey, Virginia, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to suggest that the city of Jacksonville has beautiful landscaping and greenways. But getting input from the actual down-to-earth workers who are going to need to maintain these trees or shrubs, I think is vitally important, because you are putting this infrastructure in place to smooth the traffic. You don't want to put in some kind of landscaping that's going to slow down traffic because the maintenance people are doing their job. So I'd suggest minimal, and the input from the actual workers who are going to be out there along the highways and the streets that need to maintain it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Odette, what about that?
Great suggestion, and I'll be sure to pass that along to our team. And per Florida statute, it's permitted outdoor advertising signs are accorded specific view zones by the roadway corridor. And by the same token, landscape placement in the overland corridor is restricted within these permitted view zones and must comply with state statute requirements regarding that. And so we do take into consideration a lot of the infrastructure, how we're going to irrigate, how we're going to drain it. It's very important, of course, because we want the trees to live very well and healthy. Mm-hmm. So because it's going to be our representation, it's the front corridor for folks coming into Florida. It's going to be beautifully done, and we do take into consideration your comments, and we encourage you to come to the open house this coming Thursday, July 13th, from 4:30 to 6:30 at the FDOT training building. So come on down there and bring your input and feedback, because that's what we're looking for. That's exactly what she asked.
And that's the FDOT building on Edison Street.
Correct.
It's right along I-10, right near the I-10.
By Stockton and yeah. I-10. It's at 2198 Edison Avenue. We look forward to seeing you this Thursday evening.
All right. Jessica is in San Marco. Hey, Jessica. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
I'm wondering if the toll lanes are going to affect my commute going anywhere in Jacksonville. I don't pay anything, you know, besides taxes to drive to work or to entertainment. Is that going to affect my commute in any way?
Yeah.
It can.
Good question.
If you want it to. If you choose to get a SunPass transponder and you're traveling on the 295 Beltway, that will allow you to choose to get into those managed lanes. Those are new additional lanes. They're not taking any existing lanes of traffic away from you. So your commute can stay the same, or you can choose to jump into those new lanes using a SunPass if you decide to do that once they're open.
Will the SunPass lanes go around the entire 295 Beltway?
Eventually.
that is
the way that things are trending. And certainly if you look at the future plans that the North Florida TPO group are working on, mm-hmm. you can see decades into the future where that would eventually be the hope.
Yeah. And Ron, as you all have been saying, if you travel to Orlando, Tampa, South Florida, you're familiar with SunPass.
Absolutely. And I started seeing the electronic tolling coming in around Jacksonville, I went ahead and got a SunPass because I drive through Orlando and all. So I use that with the transponder. You can move it from one vehicle to the next. You just put a little bit of money in there, and it just automatically updated with the charge card. You can get them from CVS, Walgreens, the Welcome Center, different locations like that. So.
And how much will people have to pay if they want to do SunPass and put the transponder on their windshield?
Well, I think it's for the transponder. You can go to sunpass.com. The transponder is what, 20? Is it?
There's one that's $5, yeah. And there's one that's $20.
Yeah.
The one that's $20 is portable. The one that is $5 is a sticker. And then it's really just up to you. You set up your account. You can make it where it automatically replenishes. How much it will cost you just depends on how often you use it.
Okay.
I was going to say real quick, too, Melissa, is that the express lanes that we're experiencing in the future is to help pay for the systems and all, but gives us predictability in our travels. It's to help balance out, to lessen congestion. FDOT's vision is fatality and congestion-free. You know, we're really striving toward this all around our commuting area. And so it's important, and as we look into the future.
You know, and you mentioned North Florida TPO. Of course, they are, full disclosure, they are one of our title sponsors of this program. And one thing they're very focused on is looking at the long-range impact of this area becoming more built out. Jacksonville is a lot less congested, I have to say, than the other major cities in Florida. But we are trending in that direction of more density and more congestion.
We are. And, you know, North Florida Transportation Planning Organization and all of our partners come together, our elected leaders come together. And these organizations establish the priorities. DOT is there as an ex officio in the board meetings and all. But we work through them. We develop the 5 and 10 year plans out and get the funding and the budget for that. So a lot of planning goes into this whole process. And so Jacksonville really has a great, well, whole Northeast Florida has a great planning organization that helps us in planning ahead.
Matt is in Clay County. Hey, Matt, good morning.
Yeah, hey, I was just curious if you guys know when the SunPass lanes will be up and running.
That is a great question. I'm glad you asked. We are looking at early 2018 for both the First Coast Expressway, which is that connector on State Road 23. That'll go from Blanding in Middleburg, Matt, all the way up through Oakleaf to I-10 and US 90. That's that 18-mile section. We're looking at completion and tolling beginning in early 2018 there. And from what I hear, the express lanes on 295, the first part of that project, is going to be completed and potentially opening those managed lanes under SunPass around the same time early next year.
All right. Victor on the west side. Good morning, Victor.
Hey, yes, I had a quick question about the interchange between JTB and 95 and when that project will be complete and kind of what that'll look like as a kind of a final access point.
Sure. Yeah. I'm curious about that one too. I'm frequently on that one. It's coming along, but when will it be done?
Yes, that should be done late summer this year. They're making good progress, and you will see a lot of improvements. You see the flyover that's already constructed. They're in the final stages of that. And this was part of the latter part of this project. And even if those who are coming from South Point, Salisbury area, if you want to get on to 95 to go north or south, you're going to have cleaner lanes. Part of this project, just like Overland, is to help minimize this merging, which through traffic studies, it creates safety hazards and all out there as you're trying to make last-minute merges. So it's trying to straighten out all of that. We've got cleaner lanes in there. You don't have as many conflicts for traffic in there. So late summer is what we're hoping
all
for.
All right. And you, speaking of landscaping, at Butler and 95, that project required all the trees to come down where those two roadways meet. What's the landscaping going to look like there once that's all completed?
That still is being determined. We have a landscape architect within our district for the FDOT. So they do all the planning for all of our different projects. Statewide, there's 1% of the budget goes toward landscaping as required by law, and that's divvied up per project. So that's always been in the works, and we're leaning forward in having architectural landscape architect involved into our projects early on. So because this, you know, we've got record numbers of people visiting Florida every year, and it goes up. Like last year, from the previous 2 years, it was like $6 million increase. So tourism is the number one industry. We want to make, and Jacksonville is one of the gateways, we want to make it a pleasant place to see and visit, and this is part of that initiative.
Lots of emails and tweets coming in for FTOT. Let's go to a few of them right now. Tina emails the show and asks, the Fuller-Warren Bridge was recently listed on MSN.com as the most unstable bridge in Florida. What is FDOT doing to fortify this bridge? How about that? The Fuller-Warren.
Well, we are going to be widening the bridge for starters, and we're going to be replacing some of the critical joints. Again, it hasn't been worked on really since 2002. Maintenance, of course, has been in there, and it's... It is safe because we're driving on it. If it was unsafe, we wouldn't be driving on it. And bottom line is we're going to be improving it, in fact, adding an extra lane northbound and southbound, including a shared-use path to connect San Marco and Riverside neighborhood. We're also going to be, we just mentioned about reducing weaving of traffic. We're going to do the same thing with that Interstate 95 southbound to Interstate 10 westbound. You know, lots of folks weaving to get onto Roosevelt. So there's going to be some rethinking of that, and we'll be providing a dedicated ramp to Irene and Stockton Street. We'll be widening the overpass from 95 to 10 West. So there's going to be a lot of future improvements. And it's going to be exciting because you'll be able to actually walk across the Fuller-Warren Bridge. We're going to have a lot of joggers, you know, with Geffen Park right there. There are a lot of joggers and bicyclists. You always see them. And they've been using the Acosta Bridge. Now this will hopefully in 3 years add to their little routes to run around the town.
I'd like to add too, if I could, sure. Melissa, is that people don't realize, and DOT's main functions, you know, outside of the planning aspect of it, is construction, we naturally do that, traffic operations, maintenance of our facilities. So we're involved in all of that. And maintenance has an ambitious bridge inspection program. And, you know, once we develop and build the structures, they maintain them forever. And you ought to see the list. They'd come out every week of the list of the bridge structures that they're going to be inspecting. And
sometimes, do you have information that it's an unstable bridge within your agency?
I've not seen anything on that specifically. I know they are inspected. They are required. And then once a bridge structure, and when it gets to a certain point, you know, through age and through inspections, when you see changes from one inspection to the other, then they will identify it. It could be obsolete. Means that it still meets the standard of the day, or doesn't meet standard, but it's still safe. And then you could get into bridge deficiency, and without getting all the details on that, but that's when they will mark that for potential replacement in the future. So it is inspected. All of them are inspected on a regular basis.
And there's actually a list on DOT's website for Florida bridges where you can look up the list, find out when they were built, when they were last inspected, and whether they are structurally deficient or obsolete, like Ron was saying.
Is there a bridge that is at the top of your list of concern? Maybe not that one, maybe another more outlying bridge?
Well, we had one of the like obsolete for Main Street Bridge. That's why we're having to do ongoing work for that. You know, the pulley systems, you can't do much with that because right away, but that's why they're maintaining that. And while we're inconvenient sometimes in traffic, but we've got to maintain these structures. As far as some of that replacement for overland, some of that became deficient. So we had to go ahead and schedule replacement. And that's one of the reasons outside of the merging traffic and all of that capacity, but we had to create the new structures in there.
Scott emails the show, please ask when the Beach Boulevard and University Boulevard Road project will be completed. Is that an FDOT project?
Well, it is. Yeah, it's resurfacing it up with some safety improvements. That's part of our safety improvement projects. We had an open house about a couple of years ago, I think, about that project. I think they're coming on up toward about halfway into the project. I know we were trying to cut out some left-hand turns in traffic safety. We're trying to try to redirect traffic to a degree to have people to make right turns, go down, make U-turns, which are safer than making left-hand turns across multiple traffic. So we had a lot of that has to do with drainage structures once we begin these resurfacing projects and making some improvements. We're over halfway through with that project. So we're moving right along.
Here's some tweets for you. Currently, cyclists can use the Shands Bridge instead of going all the way to Jacksonville, Palatka. Will we still be able to do so? And how about bicycle access across the Buckman Bridge? Has that ever been discussed?
I can only speak from my personal driving knowledge of the Shands Bridge. In talking about bridges, certainly the First Coast Expressway project, one of the main goals is to address the Shands Bridge. I can't imagine that there are many bicyclists who would consider the Shands route one that is necessarily the safest bike route that they can choose from. I do not believe that they are doing expansion lanes for bike lanes on the new Shands, but I can certainly check into that and get back to you.
Lots of calls, emails, and tweets, Facebook comments as we speak with Ron Tittle, Mary Justino, and Odette Stroys with FDOT. What are your transportation questions? Bob, all the way in Orange County. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Hey, I was out on State Road 100 recently, west of Stark, and there appears to be a large road project crossing State Road 100. Is that a DOT project?
Well, all we're doing is around Stark, there is construction of a trucker's route. So from 301 is going west of Stark itself to complete around there. So that is an ambitious project that we're doing to help alleviate some of that. It still brings traffic through Stark, but it helps to give an alternative for a trucker's route to go around some of that. So
and definitely don't speed down there.
Sure,
all of it is. Still. Just a word to the wise. 549-2937, Bob in Orange Park. Hi, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Just an old question. The voters in Duval County voted some years back to remove all the tolls in Duval County, and here we are again, seemingly in front of an epidemic of toll roads. How do they justify the reoccurrence of these toll roads?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that. Yeah. And, you know, toll roads are a hot potato in Jacksonville.
Right. Absolutely.
More than any other big Florida city, because as he points out, when the old toll booths were done away with, there was much rejoicing. They were seen mm-hmm. as clogging the area, holding back progress. So what about people that are really resistant to this coming back?
Right. And we do hear that a lot. And certainly you have a choice to make. These are not going to be mandated toll roads where you don't have a choice, which was the situation when I drove into downtown in my younger years back in the 1980s. The issue at the time was not necessarily the cost of the tolls, but the toll booths themselves and the congestion that they caused. You really couldn't get through downtown Jacksonville without getting stuck in a jam there because of the toll booths. These toll roads and managed lanes through SunPass are all electronic. There are no toll booths. And you do have a choice. You can use them or not use them. And that is the biggest difference. But to answer your main question about how is this happening when you're under the impression from that vote back in the late 80s, and the difference simply is city, that was a city vote, those were city projects, and these are state roads, these are state expressways. And the funding is being done through the Florida Turnpike Enterprise, not through the local tax base.
Okay, here's an email for you from Demetrius. What is FDOT doing to improve infrastructure for the impending autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, which we keep hearing are going to be flooding our roadways any day now? Actually, it's probably like maybe 5 or 10 years from now. What about that?
Well, and some of the work we're doing, and we've got a fantastic organization, well, as part of DOT and working with all of our partners through planning organization, but downtown there's a regional transportation center. They got the sensors on the roadways. We're adding them into what we call the arterials, the other side roads, the state roads and all, too, so they can monitor traffic. And it's not recorded. You know, they're seeing live traffic, and that's where you get so many news reports from what they're seeing out there on the roadways. That is part of it. That's going to be incorporated through fiber technology, some of the intelligent transportation systems we're incorporating. We've got a project going on from Jacksonville on up to the Georgia line, for instance, on 95. We're going all the way out I-10, going out toward Tallahassee. All of these are being incorporated. Even to the point of what we're doing in the lines on the road, the markings, having certain reflectivity or reflecting on there that your sensors on the vehicles are going to be picking up. So we're in this age now, and the FDOT is fully on board as we move toward this. And I think that will be great in our traffic management and safety as well.
All right. Lots of calls. Let's get in a couple more calls. Alicia in Jacksonville. Hi, Alicia. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. This is Alicia Grant. I am the president of Scenic Jacksonville.
Oh, hi.
I've been in many meetings. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good to see you again. Sorry, I just came in late on the call. I'm driving. But I have been in many meetings over the past 2 years or more since that major destruction we had of the landscaping and the forest down at the end when they started the managed lane down at the end of the Buckman Bridge. And J. Turner Butler, 295. And one of the concerns that we have is, I know that FDOT, FDOT, and I just heard as I came on this call somewhat, I guess it was Ms. Justina talking about trying to make Jacksonville look like one of the gateways to Florida. The unfortunate thing is that the way they are doing that, and I've heard other comments from FDOT about trying to make it look like iconic Florida, which means they're putting in these huge palm trees. And the palm trees that they are putting in, number one, are not iconic to Northeast Florida. They're iconic to South Florida. And they are, by the expanse with which they are putting those in, it is making Jacksonville, the whole character of Jacksonville and Northeast Florida, change. The other problem with all these palm trees is they do not bring the environmental benefits that our regular canopy trees bring that are natural to North Florida. For instance, the air filtration.
Gotcha.
The temperature control.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I'm sorry to cut you off, Alicia. We're just a little tight on time. So, you would rather not see the big palm trees. You'd rather see the traditional tree canopy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
The way Jacksonville looks.
Got it. All right. What about that, Odette? Because Scenic Jacksonville, of course, and by the way, the late Bill Brinton, the attorney that fought billboards and other visual blight, he, of course, was the major force behind Scenic Jacksonville. Alicia speaking now for that organization. What about that concern?
Alicia, thank you for your question or comments. You absolutely ought to come down and participate and provide feedback to the Overland Landscape Project. It is planned for the downtown Interstate 95 corridor. We welcome you to come there, and it's this coming Thursday from 4:30 to 6:30 at the FDOT Training Building Center, 2198 Edison Avenue. We do have a variety of canopy and understory trees proposed to provide that visual buffer, the shade within the corridor. So we really do look forward to people like yourself and others who have comments to come down and meet with our FDOT staff and project design consultants who will all be there. There's no formal presentations. We'll have maps laid out, and you can just come in for a one-on-one conversation and really make a difference.
And Odette, if I could add to that, Melissa, I was actually in a landscaping meeting recently where this exact conversation was held, and I was encouraged to hear that the actual contractor, the landscape contractor, was talking to FDOT officials about what plants and trees had the best chance of surviving in our climate and matched the look of our area and of Northeast Florida. So you're right on track with that comment, Alicia, and I'm happy to say that I've heard that conversation taking place.
Oh, well, hopefully they'll come on out for that. Again, that's an open house Thursday afternoon at the FDOT Center on Edison Avenue. Ron Tittle, Mary Justino, and Odette Stroys, lots of interest in all of this. Thanks for giving us these updates.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, later, Culpepper on the Sharks hopes for a championship win tonight. But up next, it's the film festival celebrating the St. John's River. Back in a moment.
Houses of refuge were built in Florida between 1876 and 1886 to help shipwreck victims. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Sandra Thurlow about her book on the U.S. Life-Saving Service. We'll look at early yearbooks from the University of Florida and visit the Sanford Museum. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Noelle King. Next time on 1A, the music and the message of Bob Marley still inspires peace decades after his death. A new biography of the singer's life reveals hidden steps along Marley's path to activism. Reggae, Rastafarianism, and rare tracks. Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. Tune in every Monday night at 11 and discover new music. As one of the most enduring musical genres, blues can give you a shoulder to cry on, a heart to hang on to, and is here to let you know.
Everything gonna be alright.
Blues Horizon, every Monday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I said, baby, everything gonna be alright.
Welcome back. Well, it's a unique film festival celebrating Northeast Florida's waterways through the lens of your camera. The second annual Swim Shorts Film Festival invites filmmakers of all ages and ability levels to send them short films, but they've got to feature our area's waters or your favorite water activity. All proceeds from the festival will support the St. John's Riverkeeper. And the deadline is coming up to submit your ideas and short films. Organizer Laura Burrell is here with more about Swim Shorts Film Fest. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And this is the second annual. The first one was a swimmingly successful event. Is that right?
It was fantastic. We nearly sold out the theater. We generated a lot of funds for St. John's Riverkeeper, and I think people had a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you're going to do it again. Tell us about this festival, how it works, and what the purpose is.
The purpose is to hopefully get people engaged in water activities and the love of water in Northeast Florida. Florida's got some of the best waterways. We've got, we're just surrounded by water, literally. And the how you get involved is basically you make a short film, you submit it to us by July 30th. You've got 20 days. And it can literally be about anything. It doesn't have to be fancy. It could be about a glass of water if you wanted.
There's no limit to your creativity, in other words.
Correct.
Whatever moves you, make that film.
Yes. And it could be any genre. It doesn't have to be a documentary. It doesn't have to be serious. I would prefer some comedies, though. Come on.
Yeah, I got a chance to look at some of the submissions last year, and they were really interesting. And there was a real reverence for the river, but they weren't all about the river. There were some funky entries into this, and I'm sure you'll have more this year. But here are some of the rules. This needs to be a five-minute film or less.
Correct.
So very short. And this is an all-ages festival. Kids can submit films.
Yes, I very much want children to participate. That would be wonderful.
Did you have any last time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you did.
We have five different categories, elementary, middle, high school, college, and professional, that you can submit to. And our elementary school submission was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, the deadline is July 30th. You'll go through all of the submissions and then have the big event coming up August 16th at Sunray Cinema. That's going to be exciting.
Yes. Yes. It was really fun. Tim and Shana are very generous to let us have it there.
Okay. So a video showcase of the winning films. Will only the winning films be shown at this, or how's that going to work?
We will have finalists.
Okay.
And then the winners will be selected from those finalists.
Bragging rights, film festival trophy?
Yes. We also gave out gift baskets last year that consisted of donations from local businesses, goods, and certificates. We gave out about $1,000 worth of merchandise last year.
Now, once people make their creation, Laura, they have to upload it to Vimeo. That's the preferred format.
Yes,
anything else people need to know about format and specifics?
There's a few specifics, and I would encourage people to go to the website www.swimshortsfilmfest.org. But really, please don't be intimidated. We're very, very relaxed in our regulations. We just want people to participate and to have fun.
And if you love the St. John's River, you love filmmaking, this is an easy way to combine your passions. It's the second annual Swim Shorts Film Festival. All proceeds will benefit the St. John's River Keeper. Upload your five-minute or less short film to Vimeo.com by July 30th. The festival happens August 16th at Sunray Cinema. Laura Burrell here with all the details, and she teaches filmmaking, by the way, in addition to doing this festival, so kudos to you.
Thanks.
And we'll be right back with Culpepper.
I'm at my new job, and I'm called into my boss's office, and I'm told what my first task is going to be. I'm in charge of the United Nations visit of the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
Join us for stories of false accusations, physical limitations, and trying to play host to a dictator. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Want to learn more about fitness and heart health? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out, Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor,
we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, the Sharks are going for a championship tonight.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper says, it's no surprise the Sharks are on the brink of a championship. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, after all, the Sharks were the driving force in the formation of this new league, the National Arena League. After growing unsatisfied with the Arena Football League, the Sharks forged a new direction. And while this first year of this first season of the league saw some imbalance in talent and approach, the Sharks and a handful of other teams certainly stood out from the pack. And one of those other teams that stood out was the Columbus Lions. While the Sharks were steamrolling through the league and route to a nearly perfect season, Columbus got hot at the end of the year. They came in, come into tonight's championship game having won seven straight. The Sharks won both games between the two teams this year. Low-scoring games, which we expect again tonight, but at the arena with the home crowd behind them, with an 11-1 regular season record, with an impressive postseason performance. I think the Sharks are the favorite and a chance to win a championship in the first year of the National Arena League. They also, Melissa, remember, won in 2011 in the Arena Football League, so this would be the second championship banner that the Sharks could hang if they win it tonight, kickoff at 7:30.
Still some tickets available?
I believe there are some tickets available. It'll also be televised, and that's on CW17 for those who want to watch. So there's this is going to be well accessible for sports fans in Jackson.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And especially for people that are kind of missing football.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's sort of one of the roles that the Sharks have played in their existence is the you know, spring and summertime for folks who are just football hungry. But, you know, if you want to say that the week starts today, Monday, let's say it does, today is the beginning of the last week without some kind of Jaguars football. Once the rookies report in 10 days, the fuse will be lit for training camp, and it'll only be a matter of time until the pads go on and they start hitting.
Wow.
Yeah, it's creeping up on us. By the way, I have a lot of people who come up to me and say, hey, can you just not wait until football season starts? And I try to remind them how busy life gets when football season starts. It'll get there. Don't worry.
You're the hardest working man in the sports business. Well, everybody knows that.
But, you know, listen, it doesn't get any easier when football season and soccer season going on at the same time. So it's fun, but I'll take my summer.
Yeah, you'll take a little bit of a lull.
Another couple of days.
Yeah.
So here are my three big questions heading into training camp. We'll talk more about these as camp approaches and others. But number one, I think the big question is, what kind of a season will Blake Bortles have? If the Jaguars are going to be competitive, the quarterback absolutely has to be better. Number two, what kind of an impact will Leonard Fournette have on the offense? The Jaguars drafted him in the first round out of LSU, and it's not just the impact that he can have in the running game, but on the whole team's mentality. After they drafted him, I asked Tom Coughlin, what did this say that they drafted a running back in the top of the first round? And he said, it's going to mean everybody's going to know we are going to play physical football. That means practices. That means drills. That means games, everything. That's the mentality that they're really trying to create. And finally, can the defense live up to the expectations? It looks like a unit that can be very good. They added some talent in the offseason to a good young nucleus. But will they deliver on that promise? If all three questions are answered positively, I think you're talking about a Jaguars team that can compete in what looks like a semi-weak AFC South.
Huh. Well, we'll watch that. Meanwhile, the Armada played Puerto Rico the other night.
They did, and we'll do it again shortly. They've been enjoying their best season to date. They were in contention for the spring season championship, but as they were in Puerto Rico, the Miami FC 7-0 demolishing of North Carolina FC. This is the first place team against the second place team, and Miami just absolutely destroyed them. Miami earned the spring season championship with that victory. Earlier this week, Armada head coach Mark Lowry said he wasn't concerned with the spring title. Instead, he wanted to focus on not the first 16 games, but pointing everything to game 34. Now, game 34 would be the NASL championship final. So when they were in Puerto Rico on Saturday night, earned a draw, good result on the road, probably should have been a win. There was a foul call just before an apparent Armada goal. It was iffy at best. Still, it's a point, and it leaves the Armada a win behind second place with a game in hand as they prepare for a rematch with Puerto Rico Wednesday night at UNF's Hodges Stadium.
And we gave some tickets away to that match the other day on the show. Hodges Stadium, how's that shaping up as a place for soccer?
You know, first and foremost, in terms of on the pitch, the field, the size of the field, the dimensions of the field, which are larger than they were able to be at the baseball grounds, really suits the Armada. The Armada is a very technical team. They pass the ball well. They really control possession. They like to use their speed out front, and that allows for more of that than the shorter field did at the baseball grounds. In the stands, the atmosphere is certainly different because the stands are only on one side. They don't wrap all the way around.
Yeah.
But the supporters, especially Section 904, have done a great job of creating a very good atmosphere and a very good home field advantage for the Armada.
All right. Last but not least, the Jumbo Shrimp had a victory, too.
Beat the Biloxi Shuckers 1-0 on a wild pitch in the 11th inning last night. That was the only run of the game. Same two teams play tonight and tomorrow at the baseball grounds. They play at 7:05 this evening. Nothing like the Jumbo Shrimp against the Shuckers going at it in Southern League action.
I know. I love that. You got to love the names of minor league baseball. He's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Are you still doing Sam and Cole podcast, by the way?
We are indeed. Just posted one a couple of days ago. We'll have another one coming soon. And everything about Jacksonville sports with a lot of opinion thrown in.
Oh, always welcomed. We value Cole's sports opinions and his presence every Monday on this show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, why states are rebelling against President Trump's voter fraud commission. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.